The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we've talked about the financial moving to the economic, to the political, to the geopolitical, and how you really have to take a full-on holistic approach or a multidisciplinary approach, or you're going to miss something.
Kevin, to look at those four particular areas, the financial, the economic, the political, and the geopolitical, there's a lot of other things that go along with it. You're talking about history, you're talking about philosophy, you're talking about sociology, you're talking about cultural issues and idiosyncrasies specific to a particular country. And as you look at the global perspective, these are all things that have to be taken into account. It's not just a question of looking at balance sheet issues, although those are concerns of ours as well. Today we've got a guest, and we will explore some of these things from a multidisciplinary standpoint, as we often do here on the show.
Well, David, even though these things come together, the financial, the economic, the political, and the geopolitical, a lot of times you have to understand some of the slight differences and what changes between those relationships. You know, that's something that we bring out in this year's DVD that's just coming out. Now, politics is really what's the main focus right now on effect of economics, the financial system, and actually, ultimately, geostrategy.
We remain interested in economics and finance, but the importance of Washington and decisions that are being made there from a policy standpoint are very, very important. Understanding the background, the backdrop, if you will, for the decisions that are being made is equally important, and that has changed dramatically over the last 100 to 200 years, certainly the last 100 years here in America, and that's very clear in the anatomy of an international monetary regime, the classic gold standard 1880 to 1914, Giulio Garrodi's book. Well, Kevin, as we try to make heads and tails of the balance sheet issues today, as we look at the Fed and the Treasury and their activity in the market and look at both fiscal and monetary policy, you know that I've spent a lot of time reading hither and yon, different authors, different perspectives. One of the most enjoyable reads that I've had of the last couple of years is Giulio Garrodi, both The Anatomy of an International Monetary Regime, a book that he wrote a number of years ago, as well as my original introduction to him, a book by Michael Bordeaux, in which he was featured, Monetary Regimes in Transition. And the focus that we have and our interest, particularly, Kevin, in monetary regimes is that we see in the post-Bretton Woods and post-Bretton Woods II era stresses coming into our currency market, stresses coming into the dollar-centric system that we have today. And that has a lot to do with our fiscal imbalances.
I know, David, that there was a lot of learning just in reading Monetary Regimes in Transition when it came to the gold standard, you know, that period from the 1870s up until about World War I. Honestly, you know, we've spent decades in the gold field, and yet there were so many insights that Giulio brought out.
Yeah, I felt like this year I gained a new mentor in terms of a historical understanding of gold, the gold standard, the political regime, which was the backdrop to it, and some of the complexities, both economic and political, that existed then and the differences between then and now. Giulio, thanks for joining us. Perhaps you could give us some perspective, looking at the gold standard, looking at sort of a brief history, why it worked, why it would not necessarily work today, but what we could take from it in principle and incorporate. Is there anything that we can salvage from the old system? And maybe you can put that in a current context, why these are even important questions, in your opinion, to be looking at.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me on the show. I'm a big fan of your show and what you're doing as far as educating people on not just the nuts and bolts of investments, but geopolitical and multidisciplinary analyses that have to do and that will affect their investments. So I think that's a wonderful cause. I do that myself. I'm a political economist. I believe that a number of things affect economics, and we can't just look at the bottom line, at the ledger. We have to look at more at the numbers and the kind of things that economists look at. And I think that's what you people are doing today, and that's what I've been doing in my work. Thank you very much for all the wonderful compliments and accolades you've showered on my work. You sound like we must be related somehow, I think. Well, we must be. No one said that many nice things since my uncle read the book. Well, there's a lot to say about this. First of all, as far as what the gold standard was and why it worked, people look at it as a golden age. period of from 1880 to 1914 where we had a great deal of stability in international economic relations. And very often they look at gold as the reason. In that period, we can see a number of characteristics defining monetary regimes that were quite favorable. And those characteristics come under four rubrics. One is adjustment, another is liquidity, another is confidence, and another is exchange rate. So these categories are used to judge, or they're performance categories. How well did the regime or the system perform in these four areas? That's usually how economists judge the stability or the success of a particular system. Now, it scored very highly on all four. As far as adjustment, well, we know adjustment. What adjustment means is the ability of countries to really balance their books, balance their external accounts. And if you have a fluid adjustment mechanism, that works very well. And under the gold standard, the adjustment mechanism was very, very fluid. Why? Well, because you had very few capital controls. The trade barriers were minimal. Trade barriers were restricted to tariffs. They weren't quantitative. And very often, the tariffs were bargained down. They were negotiated tariffs. So people were trading at the lowest possible tariffs. The whole idea that the gold standard adjusted through this, what Hume called the specie price flow system, simply didn't work that way. And the old story goes that gold was the thing that adjusted external accounts so that if a country bought a lot, it exported gold. Now, when it lost its gold, obviously having less gold, the value of the money went down, and so prices went down. Now, the prices went down, their products were more competitive, and then they would build back their trade surplus. In fact, really, the adjustment mechanism didn't work that way. Gold didn't travel much. Adjustment was facilitated pretty much the same way it's facilitated today through short-term capital moves. But again, it was a very fluent adjustment mechanism. Countries could balance their accounts fairly easily. Now, as far as liquidity, how much money is in the system? Well, there was abundant liquidity, and that was a function of Great Britain's banks and investors. Not necessarily the British state or the Bank of England, which is a misunderstanding that a lot of Great Britain wasn't much of a leader, but its banks and its investors did a lot to stabilize the system. It exported abundant capital, and in that period, there were very few capital controls. So again, adjustment could take place very, very easily because money could go anywhere without being impeded. So that in a sense, you had a situation where supply of money equaled the demand for money. Places that required capital could always get it. And as Great Britain started reducing net capital exports, the United States, France, and Great Britain picked up there. So there was a kind of a nice complementarity in the provision of liquidity in that period. As far as confidence, which is a third criteria, there was a great deal of confidence in convertibility. Not so much because of gold. It could have been anything, cowrie shells or silver or copper. There was great confidence that banks and countries would convert paper assets into gold. And this is something that had always been done for hundreds of years, especially among industrialized countries. The idea that a country or a bank could not convert paper into gold was embarrassing. It was something that just didn't happen. So I think that there was a lot of confidence in the orthodoxy there. So there was a rule, and that rule generated a lot of confidence. Finally, in terms of exchange rates, the exchange rates among the leading industrial countries from 1880 to 1914 literally didn't move, and that's unprecedented. We've never had a period in the international economy since the period of an international economy, which is about 1850 on, where we've had that kind of stability in exchange rates without capital control. So it's truly unprecedented. I think that a lot of it had to do with the fact that there was a very fluid adjustment mechanism, and which means countries could get capital whenever they needed to, and that kind of lubricated the exchange rate mechanism. So the exchange rate could maintain fixed exchange rates because they could always get capital when the exchange rates may have come under pressure.
So these four things, the adjustment mechanism, the liquidity, the confidence, and the exchange rates, these are ways of measuring the validity or strength or efficiency of a currency regime. And it sounds to me as if the gold standard, when you're looking at these short-term capital movements, that was not orchestrated centrally, but more on a diffuse basis, and perhaps, as you mentioned, by banks, individual banks, and investors who were allocating capital. There was no currency arbitrage, but there may have been labor and asset arbitrage from one currency to another, or from one country to another, rather. And they didn't have to worry about the inefficiency of currency transactions because, as you said, the exchange rate was pretty much fixed.
And that's fundamentally correct. And which really brings me to the main reason why all this worked well. And it's not so much that countries were using gold. It's that they were adhering to a set of rules, and these rules allowed the adjustment mechanism, liquidity, confidence, and exchange rate to function in a stable manner. And these were really oriented around monetary orthodoxy and liberalism. And monetary orthodoxy was basically the practice of a stable money. And this occurred pretty much at a micro level, not a macro level. Governments were not really, like today, orchestrating prices. Central banks were barely doing that because the central banks of the period were mostly private banks. So you didn't have the same kind of money management. Money was essentially managing itself. And when money manages itself, you have to depend on individual banks and bankers to follow stable money rules. And they did. And they did because they had to stay loyal to the dictates of convertibility, which means that when they printed notes, and of course back then we had private money, a lot of banks printed their own notes, or they issued loans, they had to have enough gold to cover those. Because if they didn't, and people came back and wanted to convert that paper, and they didn't have it, then they would basically, people would lose all confidence in them, they'd go out of business. So this was just something that wasn't done. In a sense, they practiced very good banking business. So that was the secret to that. But the liberalism played an even important part. In order to have kind of a stable adjustment mechanism, liquidity, confidence, you need countries that are willing to trade and invest in one another. You can't have a system pervaded by capital controls and trade barriers. And that's essentially what happened in the Great Depression. And that's why the Great Depression was so severe and so long. People left those rules. People forgot those rules and instituted much more protectionist measures that destroyed the international system and destroyed themselves in the end, so it was very, very counterproductive. This system was a system that was fairly apolitical. The government wasn't very involved in it. And because the government wasn't involved in the economy, economics ruled, and in economics, the primary rule is liberal exchange. So I think if you have to peg one secret, if you have to identify one of the secrets, it's the lack of government, that it was basically the late 19th century, it was pretty much apolitical. And that's changed a great deal, and that's changed everything since then. In 20th century, everything changed because the economy became politicized.
So with the politicization of a budget in sort of the post-Great Depression era, what you're saying is that the system which worked prior to could not work thereafter.
Well, yeah, and there were other mitigating circumstances, what I would call luck. Decentralized system like the gold standard without leaders, without managers, without governments regulating the system, when you think about it, it's unique. It's incredible that something like that can happen. Well, it was a very lucky period, quite fortuitous. First of all, there were no real major wars that threatened convertibility. One of the rules in gold standard practice is that you suspend convertibility during a war. This is just something countries always did in a major war. So as we know, in that period, there were no major wars or no major conflicts that would threaten convertibility. So in one respect, it was lucky. So like anything else, spontaneous systems work well when the circumstances are favorable. We know that. They're fair weather systems, right?
Mm-hmm.
And another factor was that there were a few severe financial crises also that might threaten convertibility. There were a few, but they were minor and restricted, and they were handled pretty quickly. So in those periods, if you had a major war or you had a major financial crisis, like what we had during the Great Depression, things might have been quite different. Would have had mass suspensions of convertibility, then it's not clear how the system would have restored itself. And clearly World War I is a perfect example. You have a mass disruption in the system, and the war itself was so devastating, it took the economies quite a long time to rebuild. And the old system, in trying to reestablish it, is very, very difficult. Very, very difficult times had changed. They were coming out of a crisis. So that period didn't have those kind of tumultuous events to deal with. So all went fairly well. So again, in a decentralized, apolitical system, Humpty Dumpty can sit on the wall and he doesn't have to fall. However, if you get a set of circumstances where you're unlucky, where Humpty Dumpty is pushed off the wall, then it's hard to put the pieces back together again. And that's what happened in World War I.
Let's talk about suffrage, because that certainly was in transition in the World War I, World War II period. And again, the market system may have worked prior to World War I, but post-World War I and II, politicians were more involved in economic issues, developed a different agenda. What did suffrage have to do with that?
Well, suffrage was very, very important in politicizing economics. Again, before World War I, before the turn of the century, government really wasn't involved in economics. It became involved because suffrage was extended to the middle class and the lower middle class. As you know, before the turn of the century, voting was a very exclusive privilege. Not just anyone can vote. Usually people of means. Very often you had to own property. So there wasn't universal suffrage. But when universal suffrage emerged around the turn of the century, then you could imagine that now politicians have to cater to the interests and the needs of this new enfranchised class. And what do middle class and lower middle class groups want? Well, they're not interested in war. They're not interested in imperialism or the greater glory of the country. They're interested in jobs. They're interested in keeping jobs. And that's linked to the prosperity in the system. So they want a prosperous economy, jobs, and jobs that they can keep. So the fact that you now have this large voting bloc that's primarily interested in economic performance, politicians can't be laissez-faire anymore. They can't keep their hands off. In the 19th century, you weren't punished for adverse economic outcomes. And it's interesting, you see it in the statistics. If you look at statistics on business cycles, recessions were way longer before 1914. Well, well longer. I think in the developed world, the average length of a recession was something like 3 years. And the average expansion was something like 5 years. To put this in perspective, after World War II, among industrialized countries, the average length of a recession is less than a year. And expansions, on average, are closer to 9 years. So this is very indicative of a change, of a political change. Now, politicians, you know, they can't have recessions anymore. Even in this country, recessions are very rare. Since the mid-70s, we've had, maybe I can count the recessionary periods on my right hand. So things changed because of suffrage. Now you have classes that want to be protected. And as a result, there's the rise of what I call the guardian state. I wrote an article about this, about how things changed politically. And because things changed politically, the economics changed as well. Now the state was intimately involved, and it changed the entire landscape. It changed all the relations. And as a result, it changed the monetary systems that emerged after the war. And it had an impact, a direct impact, on each of the four characteristics defining monetary systems in a way that created far greater instability than stability.
It seems like, Julia, with the rise of the guardian state, you also introduce an inflationary bias into monetary policy. And you know that clearly was inconsistent with the naturally corrective or deflationary cycle associated with the gold standard. So it can't operate when you have the need for sort of a mildly expansionary policy to accommodate fiscal policy that, again, is being directed more towards a politicized budget and a voting bloc that really does care about recessions and jobs and employment.
That's precisely true. And now, in a sense, what you've just said, fundamentally at the base of this, the fact that you can't really have, it's very difficult to have responsible monetary policy. What I mean responsible is not sound money. It's very, very difficult. There are a lot of temptations to inflate. We've seen this all throughout the century, from moderate inflation to hyperinflation. Governments have to pay their bills. They're trying to stimulate. They're trying to undertake economic stimulus to create more jobs, more investment, and they do it by printing money. But by printing too much money, then the value of the money depreciates and it becomes valueless. So you have these situations of hyperinflation that are directly caused by this politicization, this need to provide jobs and to provide economic growth, where something you didn't have in the 19th century, where politicians weren't penalized for recessions or for bad economic performances.
Now, after World War II, the U.S. acted as the world's banker. Is that likely to continue? What was there as a substructure for that may remain or may not?
Well, so far it has. And the amazing thing is it continues to be a world banker as a major deficit country. This is very, very different from what we had in the 19th century, where Great Britain was a banker, the world banker in a sense. Sterling provided the world liquidity. But the Great Britain was And I think that this kind of is indicative of power, the strength, and the confidence that people have in America, not just the American economy, but America as a nation, the military power and political power as well, that they would feel comfortable with dollars. And even with the twin deficits we have, as large as they have, the dollar is still the major reserve currency. And quite frankly, kind of a lot of countries that are trying to fight excessive inflation are, when they undertake dollarization, using, which means using a foreign currency for your own, they'll use the dollar. So there's still, even though America has a lot of problems, it's still strong enough to be the world banker. But yet, somewhere down the line, you think, the countries that are somewhat more qualified with respect to their surplus status would be China and Japan. But they're not the type of nations, given their economic culture, to step out and fill the role as world banker. They've always been somewhat isolated, somewhat regional in their economic interests. They're not internationalist nations like the United States was after World War II and remain. So it's interesting, you have the countries that have the most money to lend that are, should we say, timid lenders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a problem that we're going to have to face in the future. Will people continue having confidence in America if these twin deficits continue? And if they don't, then who is going to provide liquidity? Then, well, we're going to look to China and Japan. And are they going to be able to change their economic culture and be much more internationalist? Those are questions that are hard to answer now, but something's going to have to give.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
Looking at our fiscal imbalances, the numbers vary between $70 and $110 trillion, both in terms of present tense liabilities and future unfunded liabilities. And it seems a clear course. We've certainly seen an indication from the Chinese that they understand what that course may be exactly, but that a devaluation of the U.S. dollar, not an overnight, 20, 30, 40% devaluation, but a systematic year in, year out, persistent 2, 3, 4% inflation rate will help us as a country pay off those debts and those liabilities with depreciated currency. That's what the Chinese have accused us of, is a subtle default. Is it possible, with that as the backdrop, to remain the world's reserve currency? Or do we eventually see communities sort of put their collective muster together and come up with something else, like we've seen with the EU? Now, it certainly has its issues, but there is this currency block, countries that have come together on the basis of monetary and economic cooperation. Is it likely to be a trend that develops globally, not just in Europe, but in Asia and elsewhere, as a response to this systematic devaluation of our currency?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with the Chinese on a systematic devaluation, this conspiracy theory. I don't think there is a systematic devaluation theory. I don't think there's any intention of doing that right now. If anything, we have low inflation, very, very low inflation. We have some of the lowest interest rates, long-term interest rates we've had for the last 40 years, and that's really how you gauge inflation, by looking at long-term interest rates. I don't see that. I think it's trying to pay off your debts with depreciated money is counterproductive. It's like playing Russian roulette. Of course, China, we have, I think that's a lot of just barking and posturing on the part of China. We're having trouble with them about their currency. They won't budge on the yuan. I think it's a lot of inflammatory rhetoric between the two countries. I do think that the United States can remain the world's banker as long as it remains a powerful military and political force, and as long as its banking system, its financial markets remain strong. Because ultimately, that's what investors are looking for. They want to have confidence in their investment targets. They want a low-risk investment, and dollar is still the refuge currency along with gold. When things are going bad, people still invest in dollars and gold. And I think that's going to continue, even in periods where we have, in the past 40 or 50 years, when we've had high inflation, dollars have still been in high demand. Treasury bills have still been in high demand. And, of course, in periods when we've had low inflation, the same thing has been the case. There's been a lot of talk lately about substituting for the dollar. And, of course, a lot of that's come from China, saying, we can't depend on the dollar anymore. Maybe we should substitute SDRs, which is a ridiculous idea.
Is it ridiculous because there's not sufficient volume to accommodate world currency flows?
Not just that. People don't identify what SDR is. It's really more a unit of count for the IMF. It's not really a store of value. Not really. Not internationally. It's not recognized. It's not recognized by people. It's not recognized by businesses. Ultimately, you have to have a currency that has kind of high visibility and high exposure. And the American dollar has that. And I don't think that's going to go away soon. The idea of having something to compete with the dollar it reminds me of the late 19th century, where marks and francs were becoming more popular as reserve currencies, but they never dislodged sterling, even though Britain was going through industrial decline. So even as Britain was weakening, sterling was still the best bet. And it was still the best bet because it had the most advanced capital markets and the most prolific banking system in the world. And that's true with us, too. Our capital markets are the largest in the world. Our banks, even though now China and Japan, have the biggest banks, we no longer have the biggest banks. But as a group of banks, it's hard to find a stronger, more stable set of institutions, even with the recent meltdown. So I think that it's that people have confidence in. So even though our external accounts, it's more on a micro level that people have confidence, even though our external accounts have not been good and are moving in the wrong direction. Here it's kind of the micro that the investors are talking. They're looking at it. And here they're looking more kind of at micro. They're looking at micro indices rather than macro. In this respect, maybe they're right. They can always bet that the dollar is going to be worth something in the future.
Well, unlike comparing the marks and the francs of yesteryear with the sterling, and one of the most valuable elements in that equation was also the military and political power of Britain in the 19th century. It was external factors that changed the military and political power, and ultimately that had an impact on the perception of sterling. And the dollar was able to, in a post-World War II period, displace the sterling as the world's reserve currency. So you're looking at a long line of events and contingent factors, which are not necessarily there today, that would displace the U.S., particularly from a military and political perspective.
No, and I think, in this case, image means a lot to investors, even though they're not particularly qualities that have to do with the investment per se, but other things, symbols of strength, and certainly a strong military and a large international presence kind of gives you the image of a winner. You're a winner. You're the most powerful nation on Earth. Kind of the reason that as time progressed, banks built larger structures, and that was a symbol for people that, look at the size of this institution. Look at the size of this building, the columns. This could not possibly fail. So in a sense, it's kind of symbolic. It has symbolic power in generating confidence. And a large, powerful military presence and an international presence has the same effect that the columns and the large stone banks had on individual depositors throughout history. This can't possibly fail. This country can't possibly become insolvent. We can always get our money back, and it will have some kind of value. Yeah, I don't think that's going to change in the future, even though America is running up its twin deficits. But, again, it's managing them pretty much like Americans manage their personal accounts. I mean, we're indebted. We're highly indebted, and we just pay our debt little by little with each paycheck. And clearly, America has a very, very large paycheck, so it can keep paying those debts in perpetuity. And I have heard economists that we shouldn't really worry about our deficits because, first of all, they're not adjusted for inflation. Secondly, they're amortized. And so if we take that into account, our real deficits are far lower than they are. Well, I think that's a little bit of hyperbole, but, there is some truth to that. I don't think that we're as bad off as we are. Although I think that there's a real problem in the adjustment mechanism today, and this is a problem we didn't have in the 19th century. We're going to have to reconcile America's liberal policy with Asia's mercantilist policy, and that's what's causing so much trouble. That's why we have such a large current account deficit, where China and Japan have been running up monstrous surpluses against us. So we're the free market. We're the flea market. We're the place that they sell their goods, but we're having trouble penetrating their market, and we always have. So something's going to have to give on that. I think that's going to be a real sore point. Some kind of cooperation is going to have to emerge to stabilize that situation, because I don't think it can going like that.
So we look at Asia's mercantilism and their intransigence in changing the foreign currency exchange rates, and it seems that there's less likely the kind of conflict that we saw in the 19th and 20th century, one of war and military conflict, and perhaps more of an economic conflict ahead. Is that something that we can expect to see in the 21st century?
Absolutely. I think war is passé among advanced industrialized countries. I think war is not where it's at. Competition is not going to be on the battlefield. It's going to be fought in conference rooms. It's going to be fought across oceans with economic rhetoric. It's going to be an economic war. This economic war has been going on since the Second World War. We've had an economic war with the European Union. We've had an economic war now with Asia. We've had our economic war with Japan. Now we're having an economic war with China. Countries, regionally, countries are having economic wars among themselves. And that's really where the controversy is going to manifest itself. And I think it's a better thing. It's a better thing than using guns. But it's destabilizing nonetheless because, unfortunately, there's more incentive to end a military war than there is to end an economic war. In an economic war, you lose, but you're not devastated. And that's one thing that really concerns me. This is why I think that the Chinese have held hard on not depreciating, on dealing with the yuan situation, realigning the yuan. You know, we see it now, and something to be concerned about and how it's going to be done is questionable, but something has to happen. And I think we have more and more institutions, economic institutions in the world that can facilitate that kind of cooperation. But one of the keys to facilitating that cooperation is to somehow depoliticize economics a bit, and not actually more than a bit, but a lot. And actually, in plugging, you know, an aggressive self-promoter, but I did write a paper on that, on confronting the domestic political impediments to international economic cooperation. Well, I could give you the citation for that. I'm not sure it's appropriate for me to give it here, but I've talked about ways to do that, ways that we can depoliticize these economic confrontations in a way that they might lead to a more stable set of relations.
Well, that raises an interesting point. We've got the IMF this week, which has warned against there being a greater potential for social unrest in America and Europe as the jobs crisis continues. They fear, I quote, an explosion of social unrest. This is really the point. When you suggested earlier that we've transitioned away from a market-oriented system and an economy which really didn't have political barbs in it, really, as we moved through sort of universal suffrage and the economic system became more politicized, now we do care about jobs. I mean, we're seeing this in Spain and Portugal and Italy, where they're having to deal with austerity measures imposed from Brussels and Berlin. And at the end of the day, the people are saying, we're Spaniards, we're Portuguese, we're Italians, and we're not going to take it anymore. I mean, you know, what you suggested in that article, domestic political impediments, that's exactly what we have. But isn't that part and parcel to the system we have? Can you do away with domestic political impediments with a welfare state, whether it's in the United States or Europe or anywhere else in the world?
You can, but it'd be very, very difficult. And again, in this article that I wrote in an online journal for the G8, it explains and kind of systematically talks about ways that we might be able to do it, the ways diplomats might be able to depoliticize economic relations so we can arrive at stable outcomes again that kind of bring back some of the elements of the gold standard. The thing in the gold standard, that there were no economic wars because people didn't have different economic ideologies. That's key. Today they have different economic ideologies that are driven by specific political priorities. And so if you take those political priorities out, you have a chance of getting back a realignment of economic ideologies. I've kind of systematically gone through different ways we may be able to do that. But I think they're doing it right now. Unfortunately, very often they're doing it in a confrontational way rather than a more amicable, cooperative way. A confrontation can be counterproductive. But they are working on it. They are working on these issues. Unfortunately, you know, one of the biggest wars is going on again between West and East, and Japan and China just have not been as cooperative in taking care of problems that affect America to the extent that we'd like them to. So they've been a little bit recalcitrant there, but they're going to have to understand that symbiotic relationship, and they need our markets, and that they're going to have to give a little, both on their trade practices and on their currency policy.
Giulio, you just mentioned the domestic political impediments, an issue that you covered in an article for the G8 on one of their websites. Perhaps you could tell us where to get that, and also tell us about the article that you also wrote recently, The Advent of the Prosperous Society, a couple of resources that our listeners might benefit from in reading and thinking more deeply. And as we've said, this is one of your skills on an interdisciplinary basis, come to understand some of the issues of our day.
Right. Well, in the article entitled Advent of the Prosperous Society, which was published in the Review of Political Economy in the year 2000, I talk about structural changes in the world economy. And I try to understand why they occurred. From the 19th to the 20th century, we had a major structural shift in economic relations. And I ask why. And ultimately, one of the main reasons was politicization of economic relations, that politics came into economics after the turn of the century, whereas before, during the classical gold standard, politics really wasn't part of economics. Governments weren't very involved in it. They didn't regulate it. We had a true laissez-faire system. Well, why did that change? Well, in the article, the argument is that the extension of suffrage to the middle class and lower middle class essentially brought new players into the game. While they had no vote in the 19th century, their priorities weren't necessarily represented by politicians. And their priorities were essentially jobs, getting jobs, keeping jobs. And that was linked to prosperity of the economy. Politicians were not punished at the ballot box for recessions, for poor economic performance, for high unemployment. They just weren't punished. They were acts of God. With the advent of mass suffrage, now you had a group of players that did punish their politicians for poor economic performance. And they did it at the ballot box. And what they wanted is they wanted their politicians to guarantee them jobs, maintain jobs, and maintain economic prosperity. And this became the prime directive for politicians since. It became the prime directive for political systems, domestic political systems since. And that changed the international economic landscape in ways that I've already mentioned. So essentially, it's an interdisciplinary analysis of how politics changed the economic structure of the world over the past 150 years.
Now, can we learn anything from the gold standard, particularly a principle that would apply in this new context that would bring back a certain discipline into the monetary regime of our day and perhaps complement the adjustment mechanism, liquidity, confidence, a normal or universal exchange rate?
Yes, I think what you can learn is that ultimately there's no substitute for acting responsibly on an economic level, both at the microeconomic level and the macroeconomic level. And that's what made the gold standard work. Bankers acted responsibly. Businesses acted responsibly. In the limited role the government institutions like central banks had, they acted responsibly. They preserved convertibility in a very responsible way. They followed policies of sound money. That was the responsible thing to do. With the advent of the guardian state and the polarization of the economy, there's every incentive to be irresponsible, inflate your way out of recession, inflate your way to more jobs. Bottom line is there's a tremendous incentive to do the irresponsible thing. And if there's one thing we can learn from the gold standard is that we need to bring back rules. We need to have an agreement on rules, and that violating those rules is counterproductive, not only for the country itself, counterproductive for the international system, which feeds back on the country and ends up being counterproductive for the country as well. So it's kind of like game theory. In game theory, very often what happens, why can't groups get the things they want? Well, it's because very often each individual person has an incentive to do something different from the group, not to cooperate. And by not cooperating, that person exploits the group and gains some short-term advantages for themselves. But unfortunately, the group suffers. And in the end, the person suffers also because the group undertakes the same policies of retaliation, and then the original perpetrator suffers. So kind of we're caught in a symbiotic system here where we really depend on each other for each other's prosperity. And sometimes we lose that sense. Certainly the Chinese and the Japanese have not been very sensitized to that problem. They've remained mercantilistic and thinking more about themselves than the greater good of the international system. And of course, they're making money, but other people are suffering. But in creating a less stable international environment, they themselves will suffer. So I think if there's one thing we could learn from the gold standard is is the importance and the sanctity of rules.
Well, as we look to wrapping up our conversation today, and we certainly hope to have you back on the program in the future, we look at the financial markets and try to glean from our guests and from the information and the data that we analyze what is happening in the sphere of economics, in the sphere of finance, in the sphere of politics and geopolitics, not so much from a system-wide basis or from a structural basis where you may be looking at institutional priorities and institutional change, but as an individual investor, and take away the investor portion of that, as an individual, what are the things that you think make sense to prioritize personally in this environment, either educationally or just proactive actions that, people should be taking?
Well, first of all, I would take an interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary approach to understanding the problems and understanding where the problem areas are. And furthermore, understanding how far those problem areas can extend internationally. What are the regional impacts of the actions of particular nations? What are the international impacts of regional actions? And look at those and don't leave anything out. Learn about the culture. That's very important. We could understand a lot about Asia, about China and Japan, if we read about their culture, their society, the norms, Asian norms. We can learn so much about their economic practices, and yet people don't do that. Learn about the politics, what kind of political forces are pushing economic actions. And finally, the economics themselves, the bottom line. Who's investing where, how much, all the kind of things that standard investment analysis undertakes. But to try to get a holistic, holistic understanding of what's going on in the world and how those might affect your investments. And to be mindful of two things, that with this changing world, it creates great risk, but it also creates great opportunities. So as usual, it's pretty banal, but you want to avoid the risks and take advantage of the opportunities. But I guess that's like saying, you know, buy low, sell high.
Well, Giulio, I appreciate you joining us on the program today. I knew there was a reason why I liked you from the multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary approach that you do take. My original introduction to you in Monetary Regimes and Transition, your chapter sandwiched in between professional economists was by far the most readable, relevant, and impactful in terms of bringing history into the present in a meaningful way as it crosses over between politics and economics. So would encourage our listeners to follow the links on the website to the two articles that we mentioned by Giulio Garrodi, and not to mention The Anatomy of an International Monetary Regime, the classic gold standard 1880 to 1914, which I think is a must-read and something that every informed investor should have on their book as a primer on the period. And we look forward to having you on the program again. So, Giulio, again, thank you for being on the program, and look forward to spending some time with you next time we're on the East Coast.
Well, it was my pleasure, gentlemen. It's very interesting, and I learned a lot from you, and I learned a lot from your show. I think it's a wonderful thing, and I'm a big fan of you guys, and I look forward to talking to you soon. Thank you very much for having me on the program.
David, the articles that Giulio has written are fascinating, but, you know, he's an interesting interview as well. I like the fact that he said there really is no substitute for acting responsibly.
Well, Kevin, and that's something that he said was a part of the gold standard system, and if we could adopt some rules from that system, that it would be very appropriate and add much stability to our current monetary regime. A part of our interest in today's monetary regime, centered on the U.S. dollar, fiat though it is, greenback-centric as it may be, is that there is history here, and we are going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the history from bimetallism to monometallism, where gold was the central component, to now where there is no relation or tie to the metal. It's interesting because where we go from here, you know, we look at confidence, which we talked about today. We looked at exchange rate and the things that are on an inter-country basis very critical. Liquidity of a given currency and some sort of adjustment. This really is front and center, Kevin, for what we have in terms of the fiscal imbalances that we have, the trade imbalances that we have today, and ultimately monetary stability, whether it's here or in other places around the world.
Well, and speaking of monetary stability, you know, I was thinking back to our interview with George Friedman of Stratford, because he continued to make the point that you're going to have that confidence in the dollar as long as you maintain the strongest military. But how long can we do this and still act irresponsibly as far as the printing of fiat currency?
Well, that's a question of how long can we pay our military, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, you know, one of the things that I really liked him talking about as well, and it really does key in to what the goal of this show is a multidisciplinary approach to problems and actions, not only of governments, but individuals. You know, he talked about studying the culture and the politics and the economic. And I have to think, David, this is one of the main advantages of you being on the ground in Asia or in the Middle East or in Western Europe, wherever something's happening. It seems that you have a trip there, you know, in the given year, and we've had a lot of interviews, remote interviews, in these places that this is happening.
Kevin, it's because we do care about the issues which are most obvious, the economic and financial, but there really is no way to grasp the socio-cultural issues that underlie that unless you have some insight, and I think on the ground certainly helps with that.
Well, he talked about a holistic approach, and, you know, we know with our body, it's the same thing. You know, you can try to cure one symptom, but actually, unless you cure what's causing that symptom wherever else in the body it's occurring, it's just going to get worse or it's going to happen again. Now, I want to bring up something. Speaking of being on the ground, you're going to be actually at a conference in New Orleans. I think that's the last weekend in October, is it not?
That's correct. I'll be speaking a number of times, and then we've got time set aside both before and after the conference. If you are taking the time to be at that conference, we'd love to spend some one-on-one time there at that venue.
I would highly encourage for any listener who's going to be in that area to come and sit down, actually meet with you, David. In the meantime, if you think you're going to come, give us a call here at 800-525-9556. Ask for Karis and let her know that you're coming. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.